From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, will the next round of state budget cuts clip Texas high school football?
Kids whose parents have money get to play football. The kids whose parents don't get to play football. That's not Texas.
And the big casinos want to roll the dice on Texans voting for expanded gambling in the state.
We think the people of Texas are smart enough to decide this issue for themselves.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. When the state legislature convenes again in Austin in January 2013, it's going to seem like deja vu from the last legislative session. Although the Legislative Budget Board has yet to pronounce the expected growth rate for the state, and Susan Combs, the state comptroller, has not yet revealed the estimate for the state revenues for the next biennium, it's expected the legislature will be welcomed back to Austin, needing to cut billions of dollars from the state budget. This week, the influential Texas Public Policy Foundation held a press conference in the state capitol building, already urging lawmakers not to give in to the temptation to raise taxes in order to offset the expected budget shortfall. Arlene Wegemuth is the executive director of the Texas Public Policy Foundation.
Texas has done, as you know, especially well during the last decade compared to the rest of the country, but other states are starting to catch up by adopting Texas conservative policies. So we must continue to move forward if we want to stay ahead.
There's going to be one major difference between this coming legislative session and the previous ones. It's expected that almost half of the members will be attending their first or second session. So there's going to be a shortage of seasoned lawmakers who understand the finer points on how to craft public policy. Legislature watchers predict that this will give extra influence to corporate lobbyists, the controversial ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and the Texas Public Policy Foundation. The foundation's vice president, Bill Peacock, explained what direction that they want to be herding lawmakers.
Build a higher quality, more efficient education system. One of the things we want to do with that is enact parent triggers at the campus level and then allow voters within any particular district, school district, to enact what is known as a home rule school district. It's already in Texas statute, but it's not as accessible to the voters and the parents as it should be. We want to strengthen parental choice in those and other ways.
The foundation's director for fiscal policy, Talmadge Heflin, laid out his plan for phasing out the unpopular business franchise tax, but not replace the lost revenue. Instead, he said the economic growth will fix that, and also cutting more state programs and departments.
Reducing the footprint of state government is in order. We know if you go through the budget, there's certainly duplication of services. We think it's time to look at the programs, look at agencies, those that can be replaced by the private sector. We think that reduction needs to be done.
The overall forecast is grim for the next legislative session. And unless there is a dramatic and unforeseen change in the voter patterns of Texans on November the 6th, don't expect the state lawmakers to restore the multi-billion dollar budget education cuts. Instead, it's likely that more multi-billion dollar education budget cuts are in store for Texas. And groups like Progress Texas are already trying to fight those cuts. They're predicting that the next round of budget cuts will be so severe that a cherished Texas institution will be in danger, high school football.
They say it's just a game, but it's more than that, much more. And now, state public school cuts and frightening new plans to privatize education threaten to turn out our Friday night lights. Small schools may have to drop football altogether, says TexasFootball.com's Greg Tepper. Because, as the Texas Tribune's Morgan Smith reports, not even Texas football is safe from budget cutters anymore.
Progress Texas has created a website called SaveTexasFootball.com. Jim Moore is a director for the Progress Texas Political Action Committee.
Well, we've seen significant budget cuts, obviously. $5.4 billion in the last legislative session were cut by the governor and lawmakers from Texas public schools. And you can only cut so deeply without having to look at everything. So during the last year, under those budget cuts, we lost 10,000 teachers, just as 83,000 new students were coming into the public school system. So a lot of cuts were already made. Where do you cut next? What do you look at? And what we've discovered through our research is that a number of schools are cutting extracurricular activities. And football is not exempt from this. Obviously, you're familiar with what happened in South Texas. Premont has eliminated all sports in order to hold down budget costs and improve grades. But even the sacred in Texas, Odessa Permian, has eliminated $200,000 from its football budget because they simply have to find a way to pay teachers to educate children, and the schools are running out of money. The other thing we're seeing is that many schools are charging parents fees. You have to pay $150 if your child wants to play football or be in the band. Or there's a school in Central Texas and in Fort Worth that are now charging transportation fees for children to go to school. So we're trying to alert people that this isn't just about cutting out teachers. This isn't just about cutting out waste. It's cutting into the heart of what the full high school or middle school educational experience is about. When you cut out high school football or you affect it in a way that eliminates some children, you end up creating new forms of segregation. The kids whose parents have money get to play football. The kids whose parents don't get to play football. That's not Texas.
Some people who will take a very cynical view of your message, saying that you don't care about high school football, but you're willing to try and push these buttons because you think it's going to get a reaction from many of the blue-collar Texans who love high school football.
Well, the first thing I would say is anybody who thinks that we don't care about football is seriously mistaken. What we understand is that football is a central part of the culture of Texas. It's about who we are and what we are. It creates community in our small towns. It creates community in our big towns. And it teaches kids about life outside of the classroom. Football is very, very valuable to who we are. And yes, we care about it. And that's why we're bringing attention to the fact that people need to be aware that if we're starting to cut these kinds of programs, we are dealing with a legislature that does not take its responsibilities seriously. They're trying to force all of the funding down to the local level and make the educators in the local school districts figure out how to pay for school themselves. So what's the local district do? They find ways to cut the budget. And that's not just eliminating teachers, that's charging fees, and that's also charging your child to take part in extracurricular activities.
So let's test your premise that high school football in Texas is in jeopardy due to the cuts to the budget that we've had in Austin. So what other schools? We've had a giant stadium, a huge stadium, opened up in Allen.
$69 million stadium was built in Allen. But, Dave, what we're beginning to do is create new forms, I think, of segregation. And this is also going to be an outgrowth of what happens if we get vouchers in. So the study that the legislature has done indicates that over 2 years, 300,000 students would leave public schools and would head to private and online schools. That would drain another $2.5 to $3 billion out of the state's permanent school fund. So what happens is kids will migrate away. Schools that are barely 3 or 4 A's drop down into another category. They don't have the money. They aren't as competitive. And there's a continued drain on schools in this regard. And we end up with a situation where children whose parents have the money to get up in the morning, put gas in the car, and drive them to a private school are able to leave the underperforming school, and the poor kids are stuck there. So more and more kids are going to go to places like Allen High School, where there is a big football stadium, but the poorer district is stuck with kids whose parents can't afford to get there. So we end up with a situation where we have another imbalance that is created because we are not completely committed to a fully funded public school system. But one thing I will say is there too much of an emphasis on high school football? I mean, I get asked that question since we started this, and the answer is The answer is, in some districts, yes, there is. There is an imbalance. There's too much emphasis paid on how much a coach earns or how big the stadium is, and some of that money could be better spent elsewhere. But we don't solve that problem by throwing vouchers into the mix, and we don't solve that problem by making cuts to the classroom that are so deep that the local administrators are forced to look at extracurricular activities and money there to balance the budget.
This big segregation that you talk about between school districts, that's heading to the courts in Texas.
Yes, it is. And it's and let me tell you something. When I first became a journalist at the Capitol, it had already been introduced way back in 1968. And here we are in this legislative session will be 2013, and we still have not resolved the legal issues surrounding the constitutional mandate to provide fair and balanced and equal education for every kid in the state of Texas. We're still duking it out in the court. And the voucher system, if that gets approved in the state of Texas, that will complicate this legal fight even worse. Let's face it, kids going to school in Premont are not getting the same quality education that kids are getting going to school in Allen, where that $69 million football stadium is. They have money for football. They have money for good teachers. They have money for audiovisual equipment and extracurricular activities. And down in Premont, they're hanging on by the skin of their teeth just to go to school.
Jim Moore is a director for the Progress Texas Political Action Committee. They're warning that potential state education budget cuts could hurt the quality of high school football played in the state, and at some high schools, wipe out sports altogether. There's more information at SaveTexasFootball.com. On Monday, October 22nd, the court battle over education inequality gets underway. Lawyers representing about two-thirds of Texas school districts will stand in an Austin courtroom and argue that the legislature has once again failed to meet its constitutional obligations. But this will only be one scene out of what will be a long and protracted legal tussle over whether Texas is providing school districts with what they need to provide the constitutionally required education to all Texans. Still, Texas will be looking to make those austere education budget cuts because there isn't enough income, and the Republican leadership has sworn not to raise taxes. But there could be another solution to increase state revenue: legalize casino gambling in Texas. There is a push to allow Texans to vote on the question. John Munford is with LetTexansDecide.com.
Well, basically, we feel like the people of Texas are smart enough and independent enough and capable of making their own decisions, and we simply want the legislature to give us a referendum to allow the people of Texas to decide if they want to expand gaming in Texas or not. Let's get it out there. Let's get it decided once and for all. We are hemorrhaging billions of dollars to our neighbor states, and frankly, my hat's off to them. They've totally outsmarted us on this one.
So you want to expand gaming in Texas? Currently, we have the lottery, of course, and we have some horse racing. What level do you want to bring gaming to, like full-fledged Las Vegas-style casinos?
Well, what we'd like to do as a part of the referendum is at least expand gaming in the existing footprint and perhaps some other additions like along the coastal regions, Corpus Christi, South Padre, at least have some access to open-type gaming in limited areas. We would first start by expanding the footprint of these tracks and allowing them at least to play Texas Hold'em and other activities on their tracks. Our horse industry is in the ditch. Our breeders are exiting Texas, going to other states simply because our tracks can no longer be competitive and pay the kind of purses that our neighboring states pay. So that's one aspect of this whole initiative. But the bottom line, Dave, we want the people of Texas to decide for themselves if they want expanded gaming or not.
Why do we have to go to a statewide referendum? Why can't we just work this out through the legislature?
Well, it would require most likely an amendment to the Texas Constitution to allow expanded gaming above the lottery and pari-mutuel in Texas. So,
in the Austin American Statesman, you say that some of the surrounding states that have legalized gambling, which are benefiting from Texans crossing the border and spending their dollars there, that they are spending their money lobbying the legislature to prevent legalized gambling from coming here.
Oh, they will pull out all the stops to defeat this, and you know that's going to be expected. They're going to invest millions of dollars in campaign contributions and any activity to stop this in Texas, because we're hemorrhaging all this money to our neighbors, and they're using our money to fund their programs. Well, I think we should stop and think a minute as Texans. And, you know, you talk about expanded gambling. It's already going on out there, unlicensed, unchecked, and unregulated. I can bet my life savings, if I were a mind to, 10 minutes from the Texas Capitol in one of these eight-liner establishments. So our point is, look, let's do it the legal way. Let's get it to a vote of the people, and let's sanction it, regulate it, and police it properly. And get on with our business of investing in Texas. We think that just expanding the footprint or keeping the current footprint with perhaps adding some additions along the coast would create another 75,000 jobs in Texas, not to mention the reinvestment and investment of money back in Texas that's, again, hemorrhaging to our neighbors. So, you know, it comes down to this. We think the people of Texas are smart enough to decide this issue for themselves. We've got an organization called Let Texans Decide. It's up online, lettexansdecide.com. We hope everybody will get behind this initiative, and let's get it to a vote of the people.
You say that take an industry that's now illegal in the state, that is rampant, which is happening underground, and been able to create jobs and regulate and create tax dollars if we have a statewide vote on the issue, right?
Well, yes, I think that we don't want an illegal industry. The companies, and they're mainly Texas companies that want to reinvest in Texas, but be that as it may, we want it to be legal, and we want it to be done right and not as it is now with this rampant eight-liner business going on out there that's unpoliced, unchecked, and unregulated. It's happening, and you either go illegally and do that, or certainly borderline legal, or you go across the state lines, and I don't think Texans really feel like they're getting a straight deal here, and I think they're entirely capable of deciding this issue for themselves. And to those critics of gambling or gaming, I would say, look, it's going on anyway. Why don't we clean it up? Why don't we have it done the right way through the legal process with a vote of the people, and then we police it and regulate it, sanction it. We get some additional money down the line in the state coffers that will help, and it's certainly not a tax increase.
That's a similar argument that some people make for having a statewide vote about legalization of marijuana, that it would create revenue, it would legalize an underground industry, and it would create jobs. Would you be open to a statewide vote on the legalization of marijuana using those same points?
No, I'm not in the business of
But the philosophy is the same.
This one's been around a long time. People are, you know, engaged in the activity. In this case, they have to go across state lines to do it legally. And my point is, let's get a fundamental decision out there, get a vote of the people on this one, take it one issue at a time. I'm an old district attorney. I was an elected DA at one time, and I'm not real keen on expanding the portfolio on drugs. That's just an attitudinal thing. But on this one, it seems to me like that if you have to go across state lines to gamble legally, you know, at least let's let the people decide if they want to continue to do that.
Well, you can cross state lines and smoke marijuana legally, too. On another different point, so how does this work, you know, the mechanics of it? You have to get it past the legislature to a point to get it on the statewide ballot. They have to approve a referendum, right?
Correct. 100 votes in the House and You have to have two-thirds vote in the House and two-thirds vote on.
And would the governor be able to veto that?
No, not a referendum.
And so because Rick Perry has shown that he would not support something like this.
Yeah, I can't speak for the governor.
Well, he has in the past.
He's got his own opinions, and I respect those profoundly. I supported him strongly. But this one really is up to the people. Let's get it out there and let them decide.
John Munford is with LetTexansDecide.com, which is urging state lawmakers to put casino gambling on the ballot in Texas and let voters decide if gaming should be legalized. On Monday, early voting begins in Texas, and while there's lots of hot races down ballot, it's the top of the ticket that's sucking up most of the oxygen. It's the race between President Barack Obama and Republican challenger former Governor Mitt Romney. And while political junkies fret and wait for Election Day to get the results, there are those political polls you can watch. These polls tell a different story daily about who's going to win. And one man has been crowned king of the poll watchers, Nate Silver of the New York Times 538 blog.
538 is the number of electoral votes. Whichever candidate wins 270, wins the Electoral College. If you have a 269 tie, then we have an awful mess on our hands.
So you're really drilling down on the electoral votes because that's how you get the big prize.
Well, that's right. So this election is close enough where the electoral college math, these scenarios, could actually matter. People think, yes, technically the votes cast for the electoral college, but if one candidate's up by 3 or 4 or 5 points nationally, it's almost impossible for things to go so badly for him in individual states that he'll lose. But now, with the race being within a point or so, this bread and butter nitty gritty stuff about who's ahead in Ohio and Wisconsin and Iowa and Virginia really matters.
So you've got this tremendous track record in from the previous presidential election, deciding, figuring out who's going to win, and Senate victories as well. So what are you doing that the others are not doing?
I think what we're doing is number one, we're thinking about things in terms of probabilities. Where my background, I used to play poker. Before that, I worked in sports. And if you are used to playing cards or used to sports, you know that there's a lot of luck involved as well as a lot of skill. And the best way to hedge that is to think in terms of what are the odds. Let me handicap things. So, you know, for example, we have Obama a little bit ahead right now based on the polls in states like Ohio, for example, that could be decisive in the Electoral College. But we still give Romney a 34-35% chance of winning. So I think it's that attitude, not trying to make the perfect prediction, but saying, given the information that we have, and by the way, you should use more information when you look at all the polls and not just one poll. If you look at just one poll, you're going to usually pick the one that you like the best for the candidate you would prefer to win. So we have a set of rules that looks at all the data and thinks about them in terms of probabilities and comes to an estimate that way.
And you've said recently that people are getting too hyper about the polls. So what do you mean by that?
Meaning we're literally getting in now, I think on a typical day, about 20 or 25 polls. And if you follow Twitter from minute to minute, then every time a good Romney poll comes out, you'll have people tweeting, oh, Obama's doomed, right? And then 2 minutes later, it'll be an Obama poll showing him up 7 points in Ohio or something, and people will overreact to that one as well. People, I don't think, realize how noisy polling data can be, both between the statistical margin of error and the fact that that pollsters are applying different techniques and different methodologies. Right now, only about 10% of people actually respond to pollster surveys. So they're hoping the people that don't respond are represented by the minority of people who do. But there are a lot of different techniques, some better than others, but it's a tricky thing to figure out exactly what people are going to do. And people are way more shocked than they should be when you see polls disagree with one another. It's actually kind of more the norm than the exception.
So you said that there's a lot of noise in the polls. That helps us get into the title of your book, The Signal and the Noise. Talk about that.
So The Signal and the Noise describes what we do with all this information in the world, where the amount of information is increasing exponentially. By one estimate, 90% of all the information in the world was created in the past 2 years. The problem is most of this information is just, you know, is your daughter sending text messages about Justin Bieber or our YouTube clips of cute kittens, right? We have a lot more data and information, but not very much of it is useful. So how are we going to try and find the signal through all this mess of data and information we get. And it's a lot harder than you might think. Our first instincts are not always very good. We're not used. We've never had been bombarded so much with so much information, and our first instincts are often wrong about how to handle it.
So there's a lot of information clutter out there. If we want to get down to what's really significant, got to figure out what filters to use.
Yeah, and in fact, part of what we kind of encourage in the book is that you want to be careful about using too many filters, right? And the filter you don't want to necessarily use a filter where you're only looking at information from one news source, for instance, because they're going to tend to perceive things through a certain worldview. We all have to be selective about the amount of information we come across and we read, because there's way more of it than we can possibly incorporate on any given day when we have real lives to worry about as well. But people who take different types of information that are more diverse and get it from a more diverse set of sources and are more multidisciplined in how they evaluate things tend to do better than people who kind of bank all their bets on one particular piece of data, one particular news source being right.
You look at political pundits in your book, and you really, you know, you show that the emperor wears no clothes in that area. They are only right 50-50, flip a coin, half the time.
Yeah, so this old show, the McLaughlin Group, has been on for many years in syndication. They actually make predictions at the end of each show, whether it's who will win the election or what will happen in some European country, and you can score those predictions, as I did. And it turns out that about 50% are right and 50% are wrong. So they're basically doing no better than kind of a random monkey throwing darts at a dartboard would. But they're there mostly to provide entertainment value. We have this kind of back and forth disagreement where person says one thing, the other person takes the opposite point of view. But you know, I think that should be not labeled as being news. Necessarily, right? It's basically kind of entertainment content for political junkies.
So why is it more valuable to have entertainment and have your own values reaffirmed than actually trying to get legitimate predictions of what's going to happen in the future, which has a lot of value?
Well, look, it's because sometimes you get unpleasant news, where if you're a Democrat or Republican in the long term, look, both parties win the election about about half the time, and that means half the time you're going to wind up on the losing end, and you have to be kind of prepared for that unpleasant news. A lot of people would prefer to hear good news, and so I mean that is what's a little bit different about elections in particular, as opposed to other types of political events, is that look, if we're wrong, if our predictions are bad, and they could be, they will be one of these years, I guarantee you. At least we have a test of that, right? And if they're good, we have a test of that too. Whereas in many other aspects of politics, it's just a perpetual cycle where you can be wrong and wrong and wrong, but there's no way to verify it. Whereas elections are a reality check for politicians, for voters, and for people trying to predict the outcome alike.
So we should take some comfort in knowing that these pundits are wrong at least half the time. So if whoever candidate that I don't want to win wins and they tell me that's going to mean the end of America, then I shouldn't worry too much.
I think people made a lot of predictions about what would happen when Obama won office in 2009. That didn't really pan out. And, you know, the political landscape changes, I think, faster than people realize.
Nate Silver is the author of the book, The Signal and the Noise, and he's the writer of the New York Times political blog about polls and political probability, The 538. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to the show with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past Texas Matters programs online at tpr.org, and you can subscribe and download the free podcast on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.